Hello and welcome to Minta Dialogue, episode number 154. This interview is with my friend Andrew Grill, IBM Global Managing Partner for Social Consulting. A repeat guest on the show and a keynote speaker worldwide renowned, Andrew and I discuss digital literacy of leaders and executives, the use of social media for customer service, the best new technologies out there, and some tips on how to stay up to date in this fast-paced world, and much more. Welcome to the Minta Dialogue podcast, where we discuss brand marketing with a focus on all things digital. I am Minta Dial, your host and author of The Mindset. That's MYNDSET.com, where branding gets personal. You'll find the show notes to the blog for the upcoming interview. Let's cut to the quick. Enjoy the show.
Andrew Grill, back on the show.
Great to have you. I think it's been 3 years since we last spoke.
Well, we have to innovate. Well, two things. First of all, you got a new job.
Yep.
You're going to tell us about that. And second of all, this is a video cast, my very first one.
Is it your first one?
It is.
Wow.
So actually, for the people who are used to my show, hopefully we're not going to be showing them things in a visual capacity too much. All right, so Andrew, tell us where you are now, what you're doing these days.
So the last 18 months, I've been with IBM. As you know, I've been in startups for 12 years. When we last met, we were in the Adam Street Club, I think, after some conference.
Change of a club.
And I was then I was CEO of Cred. So fast forward to 2015, I'm now Global Managing Partner for what we call IBM Social Consulting, which is a very exciting new role.
What does that entail?
It means that what we're doing is we're becoming that one-stop shop in IBM for all things social. So bringing the best of our software services, bringing the best of our consulting people, bringing them together, and really being those subject matter experts on the nature of social consulting to go and talk to our clients. It's incredibly exciting.
So you're not really selling systems, you're more consulting and helping them figure out possibly IBM systems, but also other systems.
Yeah, it's consultative selling, so it's not a case of we think you should have these many software licenses. It's what is your business problem and how can we best solve that, and how can we take you along a journey that isn't just technology. A lot of our clients have embedded technology, and what they're saying is we need to do a change culture program. How can you take us from where we are today to this whole new way of working? And it's a step change, really.
And so you actually provide that culture change consultancy and that drive down, dig down. How far do you go into the organization?
Wow. We have thousands of change consultants. I keep discovering them throughout the organization, whose sole purpose is to do that warm and fuzzy, that people, that talent bit as well. But we also have people that are deeply involved with the software side. So we have, you know, IBM has so many rich assets. I can always find someone that can help a client on some part of their business.
So, I mean, this is something I love to work on as well. How do you bring that change down into your organization? What are kinds of avenues that in order to make that successful is to try to drive it down?
Really good example I can talk about, Tesco, the world's second largest retailer, the UK's largest retailer. Alison, who is their CHRO, said, how do you make a big company feel small? And so we helped them along their journey with a collaborations tool, but it wasn't about the technology. They already had the technology in place. They wanted to be able to get their colleagues, the people on the shop floor, talking to each other. And so it was a case of, you know, allowing them to actually have their mobiles out on the shop floor when they were wanting to communicate. Things like helping to install Wi-Fi in the store so they could connect. And once that was all there, then encouraging them to talk to each other. So a good example, I'm in store 5704, I've just had too many strawberries delivered. So rather than having to ring up head office and wait in a queue, I literally post an update on the internal social network saying, I've got too many strawberries, who wants them?
And in another store.
In another store. So they're using an internal social network, just as you and I would use Twitter to say, hey, I've got tickets tonight for the opera, I can't go. Andrew, are you interested? They're using it in the business context. But to get there, it was a number of steps from how do you encourage people to talk to each other on a mobile phone network? Then when they see the benefit of that, how do you then get senior management to keep wanting to invest in this as well? So that, for me, when you see a massive culture change when they were doing it one way and they do it another way and they can see instant benefits, is really rewarding.
Well, what are some of the kinds of challenges along the way? I mean, for example, oh, God, they're constantly on their mobile. Or how do we evaluate success of this thing? Or is there a metric that we should be looking at? Because you don't have like a reference or a benchmark. You say, well, you know, we should be at 62.3% of what?
Yeah. I think what's really interesting is that internal social is a lot easier to measure the ROI on than external. I get asked all the time, what's the ROI of social? To which I often say, for external social, it's pretty hard. for internal social, you know what the cost of a lost day of an employee is. You know what the cost of is having to ring up and tell someone the strawberries, there are too many delivered. So you can actually quantify that. So the challenge for organisations like us is to give enough metrics to senior management so they can say, we've done this for 3 months, we've got them all tweeting internally, how has it changed, what's going on? And I think also when you can actually have senior management see firsthand the impact, because remember, when I'm posting something on an internal corporate network, everyone sees it. Great example from an organisation, it was in the news so I can talk about it. We had a gentleman who had his Uber claim rejected by our expenses people. And so he put an internal post that basically said, I want a petition to bring back Uber. I want Uber to be reimbursable. Right.
Rally around Uber.
I think he probably had no idea what was going to happen next, but we actually have a thing called IBM Pulse in the organisation where we actually aggregate what is happening on our internal social network. We get the data. Mm-hmm. And Diane Gearson, who is our chief HR officer in Armonk, saw that Uber and New York was trending inside the organisation. She went and looked at the post. Now, to her credit, and this is where this works, the most senior HR professional in the whole of IBM posted directly to this person to say, I've just seen your post.
A DM. Oh, it was a DM.
Public. Okay. Posting on his thing, on the petition, it's Diane Gearson, he's HRO officer of IBM. I've just seen your post. I didn't know that we didn't accept Uber. I'm going to look into it, and I'm going to change the policy. So anyone that sees that post can see that, first of all, there was some constructive criticism, which is encouraged. Mm-hmm. The most senior HR person saw that and directly mm-hmm. took action. Mm-hmm. And I think what we've seen at IBM, we've been doing this for 5 years now, when you've got senior management actually able to literally feel the pulse of the organisation mm-hmm. and anticipate and correct issues in real time in a public way, you don't actually have that RO conversation anymore.
Yeah, because they get it.
They get it.
So, Andrew, you know, I mean, you, when you were running Cred, you were out there, obviously, you were preaching and, you know, being an example of what you needed to do
yep.
as the boss. Sometimes I feel like it's sitting in an ivory tower to say that all C-suites should also be getting it and doing it themselves. What's your position on that? Yeah. And what do you think of some of the business cases as to how to encourage more people in the C-suite to be more involved, like this lady who's yeah. on...
Great question. So what I don't advocate is every C-suite goes on social media, because for some of them it's not natural. I look at social or digital as a language. So I know that you speak French. I speak very bad French. But let's assume that IBM sent me to France for a year. I would have to very quickly learn French again, not just to understand, but to be understood. So I think what you need to do as a chief executive is not necessarily be completely proficient in the language of social and be on and tweet all the time, and I'll give you some examples in a second of people that are. But you need to know enough to understand that language. So why do people tweet? And when they do, why do they expect a response from a brand? So if you're a C-suite person, you may not be active on social, but you're seeing what's going on, you're seeing what your staff are saying, you're seeing real-time what your customers are saying, and you can go... Wow, that was actually some really amazing market
stuff,
research.
Right.
And when you use the language they understand, so I've been very successful in the boardroom in changing the language of the discussion away from social to their language. So we talk about market research, we talk about net promoter score, we talk about ROI, we talk about yield management. And they go, and this is literally
happening. Customer service.
Andrew, that's the sort of stuff we're interested in. So you're telling me you can translate all this social stuff and make sense of it in the language I understand? I'm all ears. And so I think, back to your point, not all of them should be on social, but they should know enough and learn the language to understand the power of it.
One of the things I've thought about a lot is maybe as a preparation for being out there publicly, mm-hmm. be active internally.
Yes.
Do you propose that a lot? If they're not like that comfortable, yeah. they're you know not maybe as extroverted as others.
You must have been to one of my consulting sessions. That's exactly what I do, because you want them to feel comfortable. And the example I gave with the Uber and the IBM was, here is a senior executive who was comfortable responding to something that was a bit difficult, a bit mm-hmm. of constructive feedback. And I think if they can become comfortable amongst their peers, mm-hmm. what I then do is I just give them a little push and go, okay, and you're ready. You're ready to go external now. Different language, different mm-hmm. way of doing it, but you're ready to do that. And the ones that have done that, you know, when I joined IBM, about the fourth week in, I was thrust in front of 700 IBMers at Excel to talk about what I did. And I gave the story I just told you, that you need to understand the language, you need to practice this social stuff. And I had a number of people come up to me after and say, you know what, I needed someone like you to say what you said in your own personal journey of how one tweet got your job at IBM.
Right.
I'm going to try this now. And the most humbling thing is months later, I had some of these senior VPs come up to me to say, I've done it, and I'm really enjoying it. Because what you need, what executives need, is a feedback loop.
Yeah.
So they do something, it's uncomfortable, someone, be it another colleague or a customer, comes back and said, oh, that's great, you're on social, I'm glad that you've got a voice. And they go, oh, wow, I enjoyed that, I'm going to do it again.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, if you're talking about the social external, it's always about the crisis, or what if, you know, something, a customer says something bad, or I say something wrong.
Yeah.
And so you get to practice that internally. As long as you have the culture, you give permission to everybody to say constructive criticism, and don't, you know, frown on that and you know, impeach or appall people for saying things are negative. Because if you can learn how to treat the negative, then not only will you learn how to do that externally, you're going to foster a better, more, you know, vibrant internal culture.
People feel comfortable to be constructively critical, and I think in an organization there is a right and a wrong way to do that. I don't see on a network people complaining using bad language. The guy with the Uber example, it was constructive, it was factual, saying, I just don't think it's fair. And if you read it, it'd be like, I think he's got a point. So I think when you have other people and your peers, you're not going to rant and rave. I mean, that may happen in some organizations, but I think it just on social media, if someone is tweeting me with some bad language, my community is going to go, can you stop doing that?
Right.
That's not necessary.
So you were mentioning just before some examples. Mm. Who would you say are some good examples to look at in terms of how they figured it out, their bio, the way their language, whatever?
My favorite example is Ronan Dunn from O2. Yeah, sure. So I thought you probably expected me to say that. Because, one, he totally gets social. He's on there, he's active, he's warts and all. I mean, he's not doing all the customer service.
He even supports Ireland openly.
Yeah, he does.
I like that.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but because in the end of the day, that shows that he's putting his... You know, it's him.
It's his personal
brand.
Even
if he has Britain as his domain, he's prepared to, or UK, he's prepared to talk about Ireland and say, at the risk of offending customers.
But I think he's got firsthand that by him being the voice, and it really is him doing the tweeting, not some team, he gets that direct customer feedback. He's also learned the language. Now, I think he's a new breed of executive.
Right.
The thing is, in 10 years' time, actually in 5 years' time, we won't be having this discussion because the next wave, these millennials coming through, won't be a case of, are we on Twitter? Should we be on Twitter? Well, I've been there for 6 years. I mean, I'm going to instill all those processes I've been using in my personal life and my professional life into the organization.
So just two things. First, O2 challenger, more of a challenger. Mm-hmm. Do you think that contributes to the desirability and the, you know, agility and the desire to, you know, be out there and make a difference?
Yeah, but I mean, you could say the thing about three, and I don't see three CEO being as active as Ronan is. So I think it's down to the personality. And I've met Ronan. I think it's him being very comfortable, but also very smartly taking the lead. So all of his staff are going to say, look what the chief's doing. We should do that as well. And I think when I advise clients, the hardest thing to do is to get those top leaders engaged in doing it, because everyone else is going to say, oh, I should do that too because the boss is doing it.
All right, so talking about Twitter, all right, you know, in the end of the day, there's LinkedIn and there's Twitter for business. The rest, there are other things you can use.
Sure.
But as a personal executive, Twitter is a great second space to be in, one or the other, or both.
Yeah.
But Costello's out. Is Twitter around forever? And, you know, do you, because I mean, you build up a big Twitter following and you do all that work and you learn all the things. And, and of course, that learning hopefully will be useful for Twitter too or whatever else comes out afterwards. But does that, do you think that's sort of a risk? And where do you go with that?
I think, take it back a bit. I think the risk for all social networks that started 5 or 6 years ago is they're beholden to the advertising model. So what pays the bills at the moment is an ad company on behalf of a client buying an ad unit, be it a promoted tweet, be it a suggested tweet, be it a Facebook post or whatever. And we've all talked about Facebook Zero, where to get noticed now on Facebook, you have to pay to play.
Mm-hmm.
How do you change the monetization model where you're not so reliant on the old way of advertising? Because I say this at a lot of conferences and I get beaten up for it. I don't read ads anymore. Mm. I get my marketing recommendation from you, from my network, from people I trust. And if we assume that if I'm 5 years ahead of the curve and we're both 5 years ahead, in 5 years' time you won't have as heavy reliance on above-the-line advertising, how do those social networks that are beholden to that survive? I think the richness will be in the data. So Facebook has 10 plus years of data. Twitter has 9, 8 years of data. How do you sensitively use that in a marketing way, in a way that makes me feel comfortable? I mean, I've had, in the last 7, 8 years, 33,000 tweets. I think there are probably two brands that have ever done anything with that data to delight me, yet I'm telling the world what I like, where I am, what I do. I think the data will be the thing that people start monetizing when we have ad fatigue. So to your point, I think Twitter, Facebook will be around in different incarnations. Someone will fund them differently. But I think they need to decouple themselves from the ultra-reliance on traditional advertising.
And hopefully. So do you think they need to hire a big data officer?
I would assume they have one already.
A CEO who is more data-oriented.
That's up to Henlick and Struggles, whoever's actually... but I think any organisation, and again, I mentor a number of millennials, you know some of them as well, those coming through that have a real appreciation for data and the science of data, not that they're data scientists, but just understand the power of it, will actually drive the company forward, because you've been in advertising a lot longer than I have. Eventually, consumers go, you know what? I'm being advertised to.
Right.
I don't
You're
like that.
A bunch of...
Yeah. So how do we actually do it in a different way? But going back to my point, how do you delight me with... I don't see it as an ad. I see it as a bit of information that's valuable.
Yeah.
But I don't want to see every single ad. I want to see the ones I'm interested in. But as a marketer, who wants to market to Andrew's segment of 5 versus segment of 5 million? Who's going to get your bonus for marketing to 5 people?
It's a challenge. Advertising practitioners in a survey that comes out every year are trusted slightly more than secondhand car dealers. Anyway, quite crazy. So let's say we talked to you about social media, and under the belief that social media is a valid channel for customer service, how do you qualify that statement?
So I'll answer in a slightly different way, and I came up with this analogy that I think works well. So you and I are old enough to know what a switchboard is. My daughter, when we were in Canberra, actually played with one from the museum where you actually take the plug out. And I took a friend of mine a while ago to the Science Museum and showed her an old switchboard, and she said, I've never seen one of those before. So there is a section of the generation that have never seen this. But I think a lot of companies, and especially around customer service, are becoming social switchboard. So the message comes in from whatever social channel. There is one team looking at that. And so one message is about a lost package. One message is about opening times. One message is about, how do I get a job with you?
Product default.
Yeah, and so this social switchboard has to handle everything, and they can't. My view is that the best practice customer service use of Twitter and those sort of things is actually to have something smart at the front end, like a Watson, an IBM Watson, to actually analyze this data. Aha, that piece of content is actually looks like a request for a job application. So rather than someone in the social switchboard saying, who do I give this to? It actually gets routed through to HR. HR, with some workflow tools, says, oh, we've got an inquiry from someone. It's Minta Dial. He's worked for all these other companies before. He's someone we really need to get to. And conversely, with someone in the product area or, you know, opening times. So rather than having one team that is literally being that switchboard for all the things coming in, you put some smart analysis on the front end, and then it gets triaged to the right area, and then the person best suited to deal with that can deal with it. And I call that federating the social enterprise. So I think at the moment, again, you look at a brand's Twitter feed, and it's, we're sorry about that. There's got to be a better way.
Do you have any examples of companies, Watson or not, that are managing that process?
It comes back to, I think, where you actually have the social process embedded in your existing workflow. So rather than, again, having this separate team that's just doing all the social stuff, that can't see all the things that someone on the phones and on email can do, have that built in, and maybe have multi-skilled agents. And a lot of the telcos are moving towards that model, where someone can actually pick up the phone, send a tweet, send a message, all those sort of things, with all the things at their fingertips. I think some of the airlines are doing very well. KLM is a really great example of how they do customer care. What I love about KLM is actually on their Facebook and Twitter page, they've done some bit of tech where it says, this is the wait time for your tweet. It's going to be 37 minutes between you tweeting and us getting back to
you. Right now, this time.
Right now, and it's dynamic every 5 minutes. That then says, oh, 37 minutes, it's not that urgent, I'll go and do something else, rather than hanging on the phone.
Your calls is important for us.
Yeah. So that's, I think, where airlines and telcos are doing it well. But again, we've got to move away from just having this separate little team that does customer care. because you can also start predicting things. And again, back to Watson, we can do personality insights. So when the tweet comes in from at Andrew Grill, we might be able to tell whether this is going to be a good call or a bad call because I've complained five times before. Right. I'm someone that is quite assertive. And so you might actually put a different agent on that.
Got a clout score, credit score. Certain thing. And
yeah, but maybe the agent dealing with it is actually someone who is a little more skilled with someone who's going to be a bit smarter on the product side, is a fairly aggressive customer maybe. So when I get through, I actually get someone that's going to feel my vibe and go, I'd feel that way too, Andrew.
IBM, I've followed a little bit from the outside of what you guys are doing because you have a lot of your consultants have their own personal presence.
Yes, you
put their profiles up, their LinkedIn, Twitter feed, which is for a lot of companies, you know, the far side of the moon.
Yeah, yeah.
In your area, it's more, as a consultancy area, it's more, I'd say, understandable because you're all selling information, you're in intelligence, and so putting yourselves out there and publishing makes a lot of sense. So IBM is not like an FMCG kind of company. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you're presumably being in the news for a lot of things as well.
Yeah.
And are you putting in place this program, Watson, within you, or how does that sit? Or is everyone sort of managed? Everyone is social. How does it work within?
Well, back to the consulting side. So our consulting part of the business, what we're selling is actually the people. Because when I put my name forward or one of my team's name forward to a client, the first thing to do is Google or LinkedIn and check the person's background.
Of course.
So if I'm putting forward a social business consultant to, let's say, a bank, Minterdial, this is the person that we'd like to put forward, they're going to say, what does Minter know
about
this? It's so important to have that personal brand. Mm-hmm. And I'm just about to recruit two new people, and one of them, who has a very high external eminence, said to me, when I join, can I keep blogging? And I went, of course you can. We absolutely want you to. Part of the reason we're hiring you is because of your external eminence. And in fact, yesterday I got the go-ahead to go and hire a bunch of new people. And especially in the social place, we want to get the best of breed from outside into our organization. And the way I'll find them is they will be self-evident because they will have that massive profile. They'll be practicing what they preach. So, but across the company, there are massive programs. We have what we call social business managers. We have 30-day IBM digital challenges. You could not miss the effort we put behind allowing people to get more social and encouraging them to do that. Now, I'm lucky someone like me has come into the organization kind of preset. I know what I'm doing.
Sure.
Last year, I spoke to nearly 7,000 IBMers internally about eminence and why you should do this. And I think, hopefully, some of them have said, I'm going to go and do that.
And so when let's say a tweet comes out and it refers to IBM, how is that managed internally? Is Watson handling that and then parsing it out?
We do a number of things. So we have social media managers, and I know this because I'm in contact with some of the guys that actually look at what's being said, who they're saying it to get a feel for, you know, what's the community saying about us. Right now, we're in the middle of Wimbledon. It's
IBM is highly involved.
So we're going to have a lot of messaging about our involvement at Wimbledon, and so we'll be watching that to see what people think and all those sort of things as well. So, yeah, we have a very strong, program to actually encourage and support all of our IBMers. We'd love everyone at IBM to be on social. We have a very high, I think we're the largest organization on LinkedIn. We have the most people on LinkedIn of any organization, which is
great. Do you also measure not just the number of people on, but their engagement?
Yeah.
How do you evaluate that? Do you reward people for being more active?
Part of our what we call personal business commitments every year, there's a component of that around eminence. And when I joined, I was told that, you know, you'll probably be okay with your eminence because you already got it, but I want to help others do that. So there is a component of your bonus around how eminent you are, because your value to an organization isn't just what you know, it's what you share. And so we've got highly eminent IBMers and up-and-coming IBMers that are able to share the IBM story authentically. I mean, I generally don't retweet our press releases. Not that there's anything wrong with them, but
they probably could be improved. Andrew, I can say that I'm an expert.
But I want to put my own view on that.
Right.
So I want my audience to understand from my point of view what that means. And I think it's more authentic coming from an IBMer that's actually looked at the press release. And I can augment that. So we absolutely encourage it. Yeah,
And do you measure the eminence?
We do, in a number of different ways. In fact, we do it internally as well. So on our connections platform, I'm actually able to see my own scorecard. So on that, we'll see how I'm doing compared to my group, my peers, and the organisation. And I think I've got a score of 87 out of 100, which is okay. A bit more work at the moment, but I can see where I can work on that. So we definitely measure it, yeah.
That's very cool. All right, so talking a little bit differently from social media, because you know the world is full of other things as well.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, don't you think? New tech. So what are the things that excite you in new technologies? If you look at the, I mean, besides, you know, big data as a concept, but the new technologies are out there, which ones excite you?
I'm going to go really old school. You sent me these questions beforehand, and you said, is it wearables? Is it an augmented reality? It's data. But not data as we know it. So we've all had access to data for years. I think it's a better use of data. So you look at an FMCG company or a B2B company or a tech company, they all have masses of data. And I think telcos, when I was back in Optus in Australia years ago, they were doing churn prediction models. And that really excited me. Wow, you can actually look at people's use of their mobile account per month and see whether they're a churn risk. Wow, and this is 10, 15 years ago. So I think it's not new tech, but it's a new way of using it. Companies that actually harness how to use data in a different way. Mm. We talked before about reliance on ad models. Can you start to use data as that rich resource? And it can be raw data, it can be processed data. When you start augmenting social data with customer data, transactional data, I think that can be really, really powerful. So for me, may not be the answer you're expecting, but data for me is a new bit of tech that we're not really using in the best possible way.
Well, all right, so I'm going to push back. I would say if you're in a data kind of organization, I would kind of almost expect that with IBM, that'd be a thought. That said, how do you actually handle data? The problem is, I worked in an organization, L'Oreal, that had oodles of information about the customer data that was there, but we never used it, or we did only for our purposes, our own self-serving purposes. What is it that's going to be able to help organizations manage the sort of cacophony of data that's out there, outside of the technology? Because in the end of the day, it's about the questions you ask, but how do you organize that so it's more effective?
Part of it is grabbing, and I think 10 years ago, the notion of grabbing every transactional piece of data that was there, where are you going to store it? These days, with fast data storage, with SSDs, you've got the cloud computing, you've got things like Hadoop and Cassandra that can process things really quickly. I think that's gone away, but I still think that, look at an FMCG organization, what data do they have? They have transactional data, they have research data, they have so much information. And I think the challenge is, how do they make sense of it? And how do they actually get insights out of that data? So the first thing is storing it and indexing it, but then being able to do really smart queries. And I think part of it is making it so simple that a chief executive can actually look at his or her iPad and do a few swipes and actually get some intelligence. So what are our sales figures this week for the new hair care product? Now, in the background somewhere, numbers are crunching and everything else, but when he or she can go, I was concerned about the hair care range this week. It looks like we're back on track. Don't have to worry about that. That, for me, is using executives' time wisely, because he or she doesn't have to worry about that. So I think the presentation at that business decision level is where it's going to have the most impact. Yes, you can have product managers looking at things day to day, but literally the CEO's dashboard of how's my business doing, being able to drill into that, and there are multiple technologies that can do that in a really easy way, literally on an iPad, I think is going to break down the issue, and then it'll allow chief execs to actually push back and go, no, spend more. I want to capture more data. I want to have different ways of slicing it, because I can do this myself on my iPad.
All right, so I hear you. What I'm looking for, perhaps, is the attitude or mindset that's going to allow for the data to be properly, the queries to be made and the insights to be drawn. In the end of the day, a lot of companies are going to look through through their filter. And that filter, if it's, if I've got 35 years of baggage, may be a little bit old-fashioned. What are we going to do to switch from, how's my product doing to what does the customer want?
Yeah, the customer centricity, I think, is really important. So you can't just rely on primary market research, because that's always six, eight weeks old. Can you use other sources of info? So can you use transaction data? Can you use social data? Can you use the weather? So, we did a partnership with the Weather Channel, and the weather is probably the most amazing piece of big data ever, because you can start predicting that. So the whole notion that we forecast weather, the reason the BBC can say tomorrow is going to be 30 degrees is because they've got years of experience of looking at all these data points to forecast that. So look at all the other data around you. When they talked about the Weather Channel partnership, I thought, that's the most amazing data set. that maybe an FMCG company wouldn't think about, because humidity is going to have frizzier hair, hotter weather is going to be better ice creams, all those sorts of things. Yeah. We've even done surveys with, you know, coffee companies where we understand the effect of weather on footfall. So I think we need to break out of, as you say, what data do we have? Mm-hmm. What data does the world have? Mm-hmm. Is it weather? Is it transaction? Is it currency? Is it political stability? All those sorts of things, and be able to process that to make better decisions, along with my own data that is somewhat imperfect, maybe.
Speaking of weather, you know, when I was running a division in Canada, it was always, should we say, one of those excuses that would come up when the sales memo didn't come in. Oh, well, we had bad weather, of course, in Canada. And I used to get a little bit frustrated because bad weather, well, that's just...
It happens.
Part of it, you know, and we get it kind of every year. And if we didn't get it this day, we got it the month before. And so I always get a little bit frustrated about weather. The other day, I heard that weather was when you had... more bad weather, there was a spike in e-commerce. So whereas I used to think, you know, it's about footfall and getting into the store, like in hairdressing salons in my case, now it's the reverse. Have you heard any things like this?
Yeah, I mean, stay at home, it's bad weather, I'm going to stay home and buy stuff online. Yeah. I think that is the other shift that we've seen. I mean, my wife, I was in Australia 5 years ago, and I got a phone call, she was back in London, and said, I've discovered Amazon. And my credit card's never been the same again. But she has basically said, this is more convenient for me, actually being able to choose something online and have it delivered and not going into a shop. Mm. So, and my wife is the most non-social media person you'll meet. No disrespect, honey. But she has changed her whole buying habits. And so, yeah, weather-wise, I know she probably buys more when the weather is different. So the traditional FMCG company needs to be working with the Amazons and the logistic providers to make sure that that is seamless. Mm.
I was reading at BNP, the bank, says, you know, we're a bank for the changing world. It's a changing world.
Yeah.
And no more than in new tech and social media. How do you stay up with what's going on?
Yeah.
And then how would you recommend an executive who's not just a social media guru stay up with what's going on?
So two things. So, I mean, my Twitter feed is the richest source of market research I could ever get, because the people I follow, like you, are interested in the same things I'm interested in. So I will generally find something of interest by flicking through my Twitter feed. Now, people say, you're on Twitter all the time. No, I'm not. I snack. And so after we finished here, I'll be walking to the train station. I'll flip through my Twitter feed. I'll see things that are interesting. That's my market research. I also look at traditional media, so I love The Economist. I love the writing in that. They challenge the thinking, and I always turn to the technology section on my iPad every week to see what they're talking about. And also things like the FT, and that, it comes to your point, these are not traditional, you know, I look at the Next Web, I look at Mashable and TechCrunch and those sort of things, but your pinstripe banking executive, they should maybe start at the technology section in the FT and The Economist, to sort of see what the spin is there, because again, those publications have to speak to their audience, you know, so the city for the FT, but the writers that are writing about the tech are writing in a way that they'll understand. So I would suggest they start with the tech sections of their favorite publications first.
Cool. Yeah, because basically all these mass medias are also getting with the program, I mean, whether it's New York Times and so on. So let's say, I want to go back to your snacking idea. You're just snacking, you see an article that's in TechCrunch. What's your mechanism? Because reading that as you're walking down the street is a little bit difficult. So what's your little process, the little inside Andrew Grill's mechanism?
So I bookmark it. I run my own open source bookmark, a thing called Semantic Scuttle. It's on my server. So I've got 10...
Semantic
Scuttle.
All right, cool.
It's an open source bookmark. It was built on the back of, you know, the sort of what Delicious was. It has the same Delicious APIs, but it's mine. It's on my server, and I own all the data. So I can actually, from my mobile, quickly bookmark something, put a couple of tags there, and I'll go back to it. And you know what? 6 months later, when I go, oh, what was Minda talking about? I'll actually probably put your name there, so I'll tag them. Yeah, and I can search for it, and I go
through
it.
So when you bookmark, you say you
put
tag
some tag
it.
There, and I save it, and I'll come back to it. And I know that it's there, and I can search for it as well. So I have my filing system, and it's all private. It's all, you know, only I can see it. But it means I can go and search for things later on.
I must say, this notion of tagging is an underexploited thought.
Yeah.
When you talk about data, when we talk about overload, when we talk about networking, this concept of tagging in a digital world is absolutely delicious.
Oh, yeah.
You know, random access allows us to dissect our data.
Yeah.
But we're very, I would say, disorganized in the way we tag we're a little bit chaotic. And, and as an organization, you kind of need to have the whole organization tagging in the same way in order for everybody to have sort of meta level within the organization. For you to know that, you know, it's Minter, you have to remember Minter, or do you want to write just the American in England, or how do you how do you associate me? How do you label me? And all that.
And the tagging, it's a methodology, and so I will tag something I'm interested in, maybe where it was. So if it's to do with Australia, I'll tag that, I'll tag the person involved. And I'm doing that religiously, so everything I find, I tag. And it means that when I want to find it, it's all there. And you get a structure, and you probably, I'm only using 30 or 40 different tags now. But the inside thing is important as well. When people inside our organization tag people on our internal collaborative network, that then drives what's called expertise locator. So someone's looking for a consultant based in London that knows about social business, I'll come up because I've been tagged, or other people have tagged me.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Super. Andrew, loved it. Fun. We got some blinking lights going for fun. Anyway, that's, you know, the party's coming up.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Andrew, how can someone follow you? What's the best way?
Twitter's the easiest way, at Andrew Grill. Or you can have a look at my blog, londoncalling.co. That's londoncalling.co.
How often do you blog?
More regularly now. Probably once or twice a month, maybe a bit more, when something really excites me. But Twitter is probably the place you'll find me.
I'm a regular reader. Great to have you on the show, Andrew.
Thanks, Minter. Good to see you.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes on themindset.com. That's mindset with a Y, where you can also sign up for my weekly newsletter at /subscribe. If you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes. That really makes my day. Happy trails, and enjoy Josh Sachs's Painted Fingers.
Oh, fill me with all your colors any different way to rid me of the gray. And heal me with all your imperfections that you mention in your lack of self-security. Oh, I wouldn't care about the art form as long as you would feel warm, wrapped in canvas, hold me tightly, slowly.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.